Temper on your party. Enjoy yourself, would you? We've waited a long time to celebrate your return. He turns to my teammates, huddled around the food. Hey, people, get over here and talk to Jessica, or I'll make you do laps. When Cairo barks, runners listen. In an instant, I'm surrounded by love and chatter and half-eaten pizza. And despite the weirdness of my first day back, I'm happy to be there. Happy to see that I've been missed. Chapter 12. My only class without Fiona is math, and it's the last period of the day. I have Algebra 2 trig. Fiona's down the wing in pre-calculus. She swears she's not taking calculus next year, and I refuse to take pre-calc. Enough is enough. After fifth, Fiona rushes me clear across campus to the 900 wing and is panting as she rolls me up to the front of the classroom where Ms. Rucker is erasing the board. Ms. Rucker is the one teacher we're both nervous about. She is a machine, never smiling, never flexing, never sharing anything personal. Her life is all about numbers, and her demeanor is as severe as her haircut, which is a dark, straight, asymmetrical bob. I'm sure there's a real person inside her somewhere, but after having her for Algebra 1 and 2, I've quit trying to find her. I'm just looking forward to being done with math, and being done with her. She knows who Fiona is. Not only did she have her in class last year, but Fiona's been getting my assignments from her, and obviously she knows who I am. Still, when she turns from erasing the board, she doesn't say anything like, "Welcome back," or "It's good to see you." She simply sizes me up. So I'm a little flustered, and I go into my spiel about cutting back my homework, and during it, Ms. Rucker's expression never cracks. She just watches me closely. Absorbs. It's like data in, process, response. Only the response seems to be taking a very long time. Obviously, she doesn't like the data I'm feeding her and has no intention of returning anything but request denied. So I open my binder and produce the assignments I've completed and say, "I've been doing the odds and checking my answers. It's going to be a lot of work to catch up and keep up with the new assignments." She takes my papers, looks them over, then says, "Doing the odds seems reasonable." And that's it. No smile, no nod, no quiver of any emotion whatsoever. She simply returns to wiping the boards clean and asks, "Will you be sitting with Rosa?" For a moment, my mind's a blank. Then I realize she means the special needs girl who sits in the back of the classroom. The girl in the motorized wheelchair. The girl who rarely talks and, when she does, is very hard to understand. I didn't even know her name was Rosa. "There's plenty of room at that table," Ms. Rucker says without looking over her shoulder. Inside, I panic. Yes, I'm missing a leg, but the rest of me is, well, it's normal. Do people think I'm special needs now? Is that how they see me? No, they can't. But if I start sitting with the special needs kids, that is what people will think. It just is. Ms. Rucker turns and gives me a cool, blank look. She wants an answer. My mind is a flurry of contradictions. I want to lie and say, I'm nearsighted, that I need to be up in front in my own chair, that I hop just fine. But I also think about my terror in returning to school, feeling like a freak. Is that how Rosa feels? I've never stared at her, but I have overlooked her. No, the truth is, I've totally acted like she isn't there. It's been easier, less uncomfortable for me. "Sure," I tell Ms. Rucker. "I'd be happy to sit with Rosa." She cocks her head ever so slightly, then turns to finish wiping the board. So I get situated alongside Rosa, and Fiona dashes off to class. Then the tardy bell rings and everyone falls silent, waiting for Ms. Rucker to speak. There's no "let's welcome Jessica back," just business as usual, homework out, papers exchanged, lessons reviewed. Midway through this process, Rosa surprises me by committing a cardinal sin. She passes me a note. I read it and sin right back. And after several exchanges, Rosa's told me that she has been in a wheelchair her whole life, that she can walk, but only with arm crutches, and that she was born with cerebral palsy. I also found out that she's only a freshman, loves sushi, thinks math is easy, and eats lunch in room 402. "You can join us," she writes. "We're fun." I also learned that she already knew my name, and Fiona's. "Fiona seems very nice," she tells me, adding a big, long-lashed smiley. "She's amazing," I write back, adding long, curly hair to the smiley. Rosa gives me a lopsided grin, then writes, "When do you get your leg?" "Depends," I scribble back. "Maybe next week?" "Already? Wow, congratulations. You are so lucky." My eyes sting when I read that, and it makes something in me break or connect or just change somehow. I suddenly really get that I am lucky. I'll never do a 55 flat in the 400 again, but I will stand on my own again. This wheelchair won't be with me every day of my life. Chapter 13. After school, Fiona's rolling me across campus in the direction of the courtyard when she says, "I just realized something." "What's that?" "Guess who wasn't at your party today?"
Who?
"Meryl." I shift my backpack in my lap.
"Did I miss her?"
"No." I twist to glance at Fiona. "Forget about her, would you?" Fiona grunts.
"Hard to do."
"Look, I know you hate her, but I'm starting to think you're obsessing about her because you like him." She stops wheeling and comes around to look me right in the eyes.
"What kind of friend do you think I am? You're the one who likes him. The whole thing bugs me because he should be with someone like you, not her."
"Fiona, please stop this." But she doesn't.
We thought he was smart, you know, principled. Remember his speech when he was running for class president? You said it was the most amazing thing you'd ever heard, and it was."
She starts pushing me again.
"How could he let himself be snowed by Meryl?"
She's gorgeous. She grunts again.
"Guys are so shallow."
"Look, it goes both ways. Most girls don't like Gavin because of some speech or because of his op-ed pieces in the school paper or because he's started a town-wide warmth drive. They like him because he's cute."
"Well, see, you're different. And I'm sorry, I know I've been kind of annoying about him. It just makes me mad to see her with him when she's such a princess. And you've gone through so much."
I twist around again. "Well, keep your cool, because here they come." Gavin and Meryl are quite a distance across the courtyard, but they're on the same walkway we're on, and they're definitely closing in. Meryl is linked to Gavin in her classic way, both of her arms hugging one of his as she looks up adoringly at him. It's strange, but it doesn't really bother me. I guess I've got bigger issues now than clinging to an old crush. Still, what I really want to do is steer clear of them, go in a different direction, go four-wheeling across the grass. I just don't want to have to deal with him or her. But as I'm suggesting this to Fiona, Gavin notices us. He stops for an instant, then hurries toward us, leaving Meryl clinging to air.
"Jessica!" he calls.
"Oh, I hate being a charity case," I grumble. He smiles as he approaches.
"I've been watching for you all day. I thought you'd be in the courtyard at lunch."
Fiona's right about his chin scruff. It gives him an edge, a very attractive edge, as if he needed it. Meryl's already scurried over, and the first thing she does is latch on to Gavin again.
"Hi, Jesse,"
she says.
"So good to see you."
I can feel myself bristle, like I need her phony friendliness. Fiona moves up beside me and keeps her focus on Gavin.
"The track team had a party for her in Kyra's room. The whole team was there."
She eyes Meryl.
"Well, almost the whole team."
Gavin looks at Meryl, who releases him with one hand so she can hold back a gasp of regret.
"Oh, I'm so sorry. I completely forgot." Easy to do, I suppose, Fiona says, turning a sarcastic eye toward the big, bold welcome back banner in the Greek theater. She sweeps around behind me and says, well, we've got to get moving, places to go, things to do.
Wow, I gasp when we're out of earshot. You were kind of brutal.
I have never known anyone so phony and self-absorbed, she mutters. Guys can be so dumb.
We get to the car, and I'm suddenly tired.
You made it,
she says when we're both belted in.
How are you feeling?
I laugh. I'm feeling sorry for you that you have to go to track practice. You were up all night putting together this amazing day for me, and now you have to go do what? Wind sprints? She cranks the motor.
It's actually just a team meeting, and Cairo knows I'm going to be late.
Just a team meeting? But then I realize why. Are the Glenwood relays tomorrow? She nods. As we drive along, I think about Gavin being with Meryl, and I'm surprised that it really doesn't bother me. Maybe it's the contrast between subjects. Gavin versus the Glenwood relays. Right after the last invitational meet, someone died. Someone else lost her leg. Besides, if Meryl's the kind of girl Gavin likes, then maybe I gave him too much credit. These thoughts swirl inside me for a little while and I let them stew. But in the end, the conclusion doesn't change. I'm not just consoling myself or fooling myself into believing I don't want him because my chances of having him have gone from slim to none. It's really just simple. I'm over Gavin Vance. Chapter 14. Mom's watching for me when I get home. I knew she would be. She has sun chips and cheese waiting for me in the kitchen, my favorite after-school snack. We sit and talk, and it makes me feel good that she's so interested in knowing all about my day, but honestly, how can I explain it? I tell her the basics, that my homework load is greatly reduced, that Fiona was amazing, that there was a big party for me in Cairo's room, and that people were nice to me, but I don't mention the stares or averted eyes. I don't tell her about Gavin or Meryl or Mr. Vetter's question or Ms. Rucker's cool demeanor or sitting with Rosa. I'm too tired to revisit any of the tough stuff. But, tired or not, there is one thing I have to know about. Mom, I ask as she's refilling my juice glass.
Yes, sweetheart?
Cairo mentioned there's a problem with insurance. What's going on, and why does Dad think it's Cairo's fault? The juice slows to a dribble as she looks directly at me. It runs down the pitcher, then drips onto the table.
He said that?
Yes. The pitcher wobbles a bit as she puts it down.
He shouldn't have mentioned a thing.
She shakes her head a little.
Your father will be furious.
Why? I don't get that. I don't get it at all.
Because you, of all people, shouldn't be worried or even thinking about insurance. He had no business telling you that there's a problem.
He only told me because I asked.
About insurance?
No, about why Dad's mad at him.
Your father's not mad at him, really. He's mad at the situation. And I think that in the beginning, Cairo got the brunt of that.
Well, Dad made me think he was mad at Cairo, so I asked, okay?
Mom sighs. Well, now he will be.
He'll be mad at Cairo? Look, none of it is his fault. He's aged 10 years since the wreck. He wears a Lucy bracelet, okay?
Mom heaves another sigh.
So tell me what's going on with insurance. I don't understand what the big problem is.
I stare at her as she considers this for what seems like an eternity. Finally, she takes a deep breath and says,
it's nothing that time won't take care of. Everything will be okay. It's just that payment is clogged because the different insurance companies are dragging their feet, each pointing the finger at the other. I frown at her.
What does that mean?
She closes her eyes, takes another deep breath, holds it for another eternity, and finally says, Jack Lowe didn't have insurance.
The guy in the truck that hit us?
Right. See, normally, since the accident was his fault, his insurance company would pay your medical bills, but he didn't have insurance. His truck wasn't even legally registered. He had current tags, but the police think he peeled them off another vehicle to avoid getting stopped. I let this sink in.
But who does he work for? Don't they have insurance?
She sighs. He worked for himself. He was a freelance junk hauler and got paid by the job.
So that's it? There's no insurance, no money?
Well, he's still liable, or his estate is now, and he did own property, a sizable chunk of it up near Penn Lake, where his widow lives.
So what then? Will she have to sell it to pay for the hospital bills?
My mother nods.
Yes, but of course she doesn't want to, so she's hired a lawyer to fight it.
Meanwhile, the school district and the bus company are both claiming no fault and so far haven't picked up any of the expenses.
Wait, the buses aren't owned by the school?
That's right. Apparently, they are owned by a subcontractor with separate insurance. It's all very complicated, with lots of people in lots of offices claiming it's not their liability. A question hovers in my mind.
But don't we have insurance?
My voice is small because I'm pretty sure I already know the answer.
We do on your dad. Health, life, disability. We got the works on him.
She shakes her head and wipes the juice up with a napkin.
We used to have it for the rest of us, but the cost was so high that we let it go, and we never imagined this.
I let this all sink in, then ask,
so who's been paying the bills?
Her lips pinch together as she breathes in through her nose.
As I said, it's going to take some time to sort this out.
But meanwhile, how much money are we talking about?
Meanwhile, it's not your job to worry about this. It will all work itself out, okay? Your sole focus should be getting back into life.
She smiles at me,
which it sounds like you did a great job of today.
I'm quiet, thinking. She gets that way, too. Then she stands and clears our paper plates.
If you don't mind, she says softly, let's keep this conversation between the two of us. I don't know who your dad would be madder at, your coach or me.
Keeping it between us is not hard to do. Dad works late and then is gone early. He hasn't been around much since I came home from the hospital, and now I understand why. I still have to see doctors. I still need to get a leg. Someone has to pay the bills.
Chapter 15. Saturday, I submerge myself in homework. I actually like it, which feels odd. Homework has always been something to dread. Now it's something I can do. I try hard not to think about the team running at the Glenwood Relays. I try to block out memories of the fun we had there last year. I try to block out how the last invitational ended. Dad and Mom and Kaylee move me back into my bedroom on Sunday because I insist on it. I'm good at scooting up the stairs now. I hop around everywhere or use the crutches. I can actually pinch a crutch with my armpit and carry something while I move. And I discover crawling. Rediscover, I suppose. I don't know what took me so long to try it. It's quicker than hopping, but I only do it on rugs or carpets and only when I'm alone because seeing me crawl really bothers my mom. Sunday night, I take a shower. It's gotten easier, especially now that Dad's bought a real shower seat and installed a step on either side of the tub curb so I don't have to land on the door guide.
I do my usual routine, then shut off the water and treat my stump the way I'm supposed to. I massage it, rough it up with the hand towel, beat it with the towel folded. It can take a lot more pressure than it used to, and I push the towel therapy until I can really feel it. Even with the rough treatment, there is no shooting pain. And the scar's red, but it's no longer tender or swollen. I still get phantom pains, but not as often, and they're not as severe. It's like my stump is giving up being angry, giving up fighting back, like it's ready for a truce. I maneuver out of the shower, and as I'm dressing, I think about my leg. Not the one I've lost, the one they'll build me. How does that work? What will it be like? Hank tried to explain it when I was in the hospital, but I couldn't bear to listen. He had a brochure with pictures of legs. They had plastic feet, a pipe for a calf. They were Frankensteinish. In my mind, he became Hankenstein, somebody I didn't want to see. But now the idea of a leg, any leg, seems better than crutching, or wheeling, or hopping, or scooting, or crawling. What a liberating luxury walking would be. It's the first time I've thought about this without someone else bringing it up. It's the first time I haven't thought that the only leg I want is the one I can't have. It's the first time I've felt ready. And suddenly, I want it now. Part 3. Straight Away. Chapter 1. Monday, during science, a note from the office gets delivered to me. There's a single line scrawled beneath the checked report to office immediately box. Doctor appointment. I'm a little stunned. I knew Mom was going to get me an appointment with Dr. Wells, but I wasn't expecting one so soon. I strap on my backpack, and Fiona helps me down the ramp. I'm crutching my way around school today, and it's been going okay, except for the ramps. I have a tough time with them, which I find strangely ironic. I'll be fine, I say to Fiona as she starts to follow me to the office. You need to go in there and take notes for us, okay? She hesitates, but I shoo her off and hobble across the campus. It's quite a distance to the office, and I am relieved to finally get there. The backpack has become heavier with every step, and my arms are sore. But my mom's waiting for me, full of energy. Dr. Wells had an 11:30 cancellation. If we hurry, we'll make it. We do hurry, and we do make it, and then we fidget in the waiting room for almost an hour. The meeting itself is short. When we're finally in an examining room, Dr. Wells appears almost immediately.
Hello, Jessica, he says.
Then wheels over to me on his doctor's stool. He inspects my stump, prods it, measures it, then says,
Outstanding.
He whips a prescription pad from his white coat pocket.
You are definitely ready for a preparatory prosthesis, and in record time.
He scribbles on the pad, then peels off the prescription and hands it to me.
Good work, and congratulations.
He's already on his way out the door when my mom says, So, we take this to Hank Kruber?
Or any other prosthetist?
Who would you recommend? Dr. Wells stops in the open doorway.
Hank's a good choice. And you do want to stay local. Jessica will be needing regular adjustments, especially since she's almost certainly still growing.
When we get home, my mom looks up prosthetists in the phone book, and what she discovers is that if we are going to stay local, Hank Kruber is our only choice. Hankenstein's fine, Mom, I tell her. She turns to look at me. Hankenstein? I shrug. My head was in a bad place in the hospital. He thought a pipe leg was something I should be thrilled about, but if he can get me walking, let's go.
Hankenstein, she chuckles,
then finds the number and makes the call. When she's done, she says, The receptionist was so nice. She'll work us in at 10 tomorrow morning. She says to wear shorts. So the next day, I miss more school and report to Hankenstein's lab. It's on a busy part of Grand Avenue behind a fenced-off gas station and next to a laundromat. The asphalt parking lot is full of potholes, and there's trash blown up against the building. A faded blue sign reads, Quality Orthotics and Prosthetics. So we know we're in the right place. It just feels wrong. My mom unstraps her seatbelt.
Let's just go in and see what we think, okay?
I nod and work myself and my crutches out of the passenger seat. I feel strange in shorts. Vulnerable.
If you don't like it here, she whispers as we near the entrance, we'll take you someplace else.
I know she's just being nice and that I don't really have a choice. Still, I'm glad she said it. The waiting room is set up like a doctor's office, only the chairs are plain molded plastic, and instead of carpeting, there's chipped linoleum. There's an odd smell to the place, too. Not bad, just sort of industrial. An elderly couple is already in the waiting room. The man is in a wheelchair, and he's holding a fake leg across his lap. His wife is sitting beside him with her purse in her lap. They look us over without smiling or saying hello, and the old man seems very unhappy, like he'd sooner hurl his leg than wear it. We go up to the reception counter, and I try to ban thoughts of my future from my mind. I do not want to be a crabby old lady holding a leg in my lap. I just don't. The receptionist is younger than my mom. Actually, she's not much older than I am. Maybe in her early 20s?
Hi, she says across the counter. You must be Jessica.
She's like sunshine through my cloud of uncertainty. I smile and nod, and since she's wearing a name tag, I say, And you must be Chloe. We both laugh, and suddenly I feel more at ease. Nothing's changed but the vibe in the room, but it helps. She gives my mom a clipboard with paperwork to fill out, then leans forward a little and says to me, Hank will have you walking again in no time. He's really good. I nod and smile, and in that moment, I believe her. Then my mom and I sit in the hard plastic chairs, and I am confronted with the reality of the old man and his leg again. He just sits there, sullen. His wife just sits there, quiet. Mom's completed about half the paperwork when Chloe appears in the waiting room. She's not wearing a nurse-type smock or shoes, just regular clothes, jeans, a knit top, and flats. The only thing that gives away that she works there is her name tag. She smiles at the old man and says, You can come on back, Mr. Benson. His response is a frown and a grunt. It is also, apparently, a signal for his wife to roll him out of the waiting room. Chloe tosses me a little shrug and follows them. Then we sit there for what seems like an eternity. Chloe splits her time between the desk and somewhere in the back. She apologizes several times for how long it's taking and finally comes out into the waiting room and sits beside me. He's almost done. She looks at my mom. I really didn't think it would take this long. I'm sorry.
That's all right, my mom says. I appreciate you working us in.
Chloe looks at me, looks away, looks at me again, and finally says,
Things will change. From here on, they'll get better.
She seems to be choosing her words carefully, like each one carries a meaning beyond its definition. She gives a nervous laugh. I don't usually come out and accost the patient, sorry. It's just that Hank told me about you and I can relate. Again, there's more to these words than I can puzzle out. I'm trying, but I'm not quite there. My mom's trying, too.
Was somebody in your family in an accident?
Chloe shakes her head. She knocks on her leg with a solid clunk, clunk.
I'm a BK amputee, too. I lost mine to cancer when I was a kid.
From the hallway, we hear, Chloe! She jumps up and hurries across the room, and in the blink of an eye, she's gone, leaving me with my jaw dangling.
Chapter 2
Mr. Benson leaves in his wheelchair, his legs still in his lap. He looks even grumpier than he did before. "Remember to practice with it, Mr. Benson," Chloe calls after him. He doesn't say a word. Chloe smiles at me. "Your turn." As she leads us down the hallway, I watch her legs. Her movements are smooth, assured. Part of me doesn't quite believe she's got a fake leg. The rest of me is enormously encouraged. She takes us to a small room with a patient table and a service sink. The floor is stained dusty white, like a chalkboard that won't come clean. It's not just the floor, either. The cupboard doors, the sink, the chairs, there's chalky whiteness everywhere. "Just sit up here," Chloe says, pulling fresh paper over the table. "Hank will take some measurements, do a cast." She smiles at me, nothing that hurts. When she's gone, my mom whispers, "That's amazing. I sure can't tell." Hank walks in. He's the same guy I remember from my hospital nightmare. Stocky, bald, partially preoccupied, like half of him is somewhere else. I notice his shoes, his pants, his shirt. They're all smudged chalky white.
"Jessica," he says.
Like the other half of him has finally arrived. He seems genuinely happy to see me.
"Good to see you looking so well."
Turns to my mom.
"Hello, Mrs. Carlisle. How are you?"
Mom nods. But he's waiting for a real answer, so she says, "Better than the last time you saw me."
"Good."
He scoots a chair up to me and says,
"So, let's get you fitted for a leg, shall we?"
He has me take off my shrinker sock and my left shoe and sock, too. Then he starts measuring. He uses tools like I've seen my dad use. A metal caliper, a tape measure, something that looks just like a carpenter's square. He takes all sorts of measurements of my stump side and of my good side, too. And when he's all done, he nods and says,
"And what kind of shoe do you normally wear?"
I point to my running shoe. "These." He picks up the shoe and makes a note of the size, then says,
"Okay, we're ready to make a cast of your residual limb. From that, we'll be able to make a plaster model, and from that, we'll build your first socket."
Mom asks, "The socket's the part that goes over over the residual limb?"
"That's right. Once we've got a comfortable socket, we'll add the pylon and the foot, but first things first. We do a cast."
He goes to a cupboard, pulls out a box of supplies, and hands me a long, simple belt with a sliding clasp.
"Fasten this around your waist,"
he says, then proceeds to untangle three adjustable straps that have little clamps on both ends. He puts the straps aside, then produces a short, very thin stocking, which he pulls onto my stump. It's smooth and soft, almost silky.
"We cover your residual leg with this first," he says, "because it makes it much easier to remove the cast."
Next, he attaches the stocking to the belt around my waist with the three straps. And when he's sure it's secure and the stocking is on smooth and tight, he says,
"Just a few markings and we're ready."
Right on top of the stocking, he begins marking places around my knee, along what's left of my shin, my scar, points where bones stick out. The pencil he's using is blue, and when he's done, the stocking looks like a little kid scribbled on it.
"These markings will transfer to the cast," he explains. "They'll show me where we can put pressure, also where we should relieve it."
Next, he fills a small bowl with water and brings it and two rolls of chalky-looking white gauze over to the table.
"Have you ever had a cast?"
I shake my head.
"It doesn't take long."
He dunks one of the gauzy rolls into the bowl of water, and when it's wet, he starts wrapping it around my leg, spiraling from the knee down to the end of the stump and back up.
"This has plaster of Paris in it," he tells me as he wraps. "The water creates an exothermic reaction. You feel it warming up?"
I nod because my stump is getting warmer and warmer. It's not uncomfortable. More like a hot towel wrap. He uses both rolls, then tells me to relax my leg and begins massaging the plaster of Paris around.
"We need good contact," he says, "so we get an accurate impression."
When he's done massaging the plaster, he smooths it down with his hands, then presses his thumb around the bottom part of my kneecap, getting a good impression of that area.
"There," he says. "Now we wait a few minutes for it to harden, and that's it. Easy, huh?"
He cleans up while we wait. There are plaster drips here and there, including on his shoes, and a scuff of it on his pants. He chuckles when he sees me watching him.
"Yes, it's hopeless," he says, "but I still try."
I can feel the cast start to lose its heat, and after a few more minutes, Hank checks it, then unclamps the straps and says,
"Ready?"
I nod, and after some gentle wiggling, the cast slides right off. He looks it over and smiles.
"Beautiful."
Mom asks, "So how long does it take for you to make the socket?"
"Usually about a week."
He looks from her to me and then says,
"But how about I shoot for Friday?"
"That would be great," she says.
He nods. "We'll give you a call when it's ready."
I tie on my left shoe and gather my crutches, and on the way out, I run into Chloe in the hallway. "Oh, excuse me," she says, and dances out of my way. We smile and say our goodbyes, and as I hobble out to the car on my crutches, I am filled with a very strange feeling. One I thought I might never feel again. Hope. Chapter 3. I missed math on Monday because of my appointment with Dr. Wells, and although Fiona got the homework for me, I had trouble with the lesson and don't want to miss another day of math if I can help it. So after my fitting at Hank's, Mom and I go through the Taco Bell drive-thru, and I gobble down lunch and get back to school in time for fifth and sixth periods. I manage to catch Fiona up on the day's events during fifth, and I make her laugh, too, by calling in Hankenstein's lab. "Wow," she says as she's walking with me over to the math wing. "Chloe sounds amazing." "She is. If she hadn't knocked on her leg, I would never have known which one was fake." So I hobble into math in a fine mood and sit in a chair that I pull up next to Rosa.
"I missed you yesterday,"
she says. And as I'm watching her lips working at decoding her words, she adds,
"I was a little worried."
"I'm fine," I assure her, and I feel good that she missed me. So I start babbling about being fitted for a leg at Hankenstein's lab. She laughs, too, and I'm really enjoying that I'm making people laugh instead of squirm or turn away. I'm also feeling good that Rosa missed me and was worried about me. Something about it is incredibly sweet. Then the tardy bell rings. "Pass your homework all the way over," Ms. Rucker commands. She's looking even more stony-faced than usual, sizing up the class from behind her podium. "All the way over?" somebody asks. "We're not grading them?" "All the way," Miss Rucker replies. "Oh, boy," I grumble because my paper is incomplete. "Barely started" is more accurate. I'd planned to get help from Fiona, but it hadn't happened. And I'd planned to fill in the blanks during the explanation, like a lot of people do, but there's no getting away with that now. Ms. Rucker strolls toward us down the aisle, collecting papers as she approaches. I know better than to try to explain about going to Dr. Wells and getting my leg cast today. I know that in Ms. Rucker's eyes, no excuse could validate such a miserable attempt at the homework. Rosa sees my paper, and her eyes grow wide. She passes hers to me and whispers something, but I can't understand it, and I'm not in the right frame of mind to try. Instinctively, I place her work on top of mine. The penmanship is jagged, like her hands can't quite produce a smooth line. The numbers are a combination of miniature lightning bolts and uneven curves, but the work, the process, the steps, they're all tidy and easy to follow, with the answers clearly boxed. Ms. Rucker takes the papers from me, inspecting them as she turns and walks toward the front of the classroom. It takes only 3 steps for her to stop and level a look at me over her shoulder. The look lasts maybe 2 seconds, but in that time she manages to convey disappointment, doubt, and resentment. Here she let me slide on half the problems for all the days I was absent. Why can't I show more effort?
I want to scream because I've missed a month of school. That's why. Because I just about died. That's why. Because everything I do is hard now. That's why.
Instead, my chin quivers and I turn away. Rosa passes me a note.
I can help you after school. My mom's picking me up right after, I write back. Way inside, though, I know this is an excuse. The truth is, I'd rather have Fiona help me. I can understand Fiona. She's my friend. She's comfortable.
Rosa writes, call me if you want, and jots down her phone number. I smile and nod and tuck away the note, then turn my attention to the board where Ms. Rucker has begun the lesson. It's hard to concentrate, though. I sailed into class feeling sunny and hopeful, but now here I am. Crashed against the rocks again. Chapter 4. That night, I bury myself in homework. But at bedtime, I still don't feel like I've made a dent. There's so much reading to do, especially in language and history. But what worries me most is math, especially the new assignments. Today's math, yesterday's math. They're adding up quickly to tomorrow's headache. I try calling Fiona, but can't reach her. First, she's at track, then she's out with her mother, then she's busy with someone else. At 10:30, I give up and tell myself that I'll get her to help me in the morning. But in the morning, Fiona calls to say she overslept, and Mom barely gets me to school on time. There is absolutely no chance for Fiona to help me during the morning classes, and at lunch, she rushes off to some meeting. Hey, I call after her, I really need help with math. I'm sorry, she calls back. If I could get out of this, I would. She's gone, and I'm left leaning on my crutches, not even knowing where she's going that's so important. Darn. I grumble, and I'm feeling very frustrated as I hobble toward the courtyard to eat the lunch Mom packed me. I'm hating math, hating Ms. Rucker. Plus, I don't even know where I'm going to eat or who I'm going to sit with. It's been ages since I've had lunch in the courtyard. And the closer I get to it, the more I do not want to go there, especially without Fiona. I'm also feeling really dumb about Rosa. Why didn't I call her last night? So I'm mad at Miss Rucker and mad at myself, and I'm hobbling by the 400 wing when I remember Rosa eats in room 402. I stop for a second, then turn and find the room. And when I peek through the door, there's Rosa in her wheelchair, laughing with two other girls in wheelchairs. There are also two boys and a teacher in the classroom. The boys are working on an impressively large Lincoln log house that's made out of pretzel sticks. The teacher's reading a book.
Hey!
Rosa calls, beaming a bright smile my way. I hobble in and sit in a chair near her.
I am so lost in math.
I'll help you, she says.
Her voice sounds a little like voices do when you try to talk underwater, but now it's music to my ears.
Oh, thank you, I say and pull out the assignment.
First, Rosa introduces me to her friends.
This is Lisha and Pani. The guys are Illy and Twent.
I translate this to mean Alicia and Penny, Billy and Trent, but I'm not entirely sure. And I'm Mrs. Wall, the teacher calls with a friendly wave. You must be Jessica. I nod and smile, but I feel a little uncomfortable that she already knows who I am. Rosa gets right down to the math. She shows me her homework and points me through the steps as she explains the problems.
Okay, to find the first three iterates of this function. Here's what you do.
I struggle to understand her, especially since she's speaking math, a language I'm already having trouble with. But seeing her work really helps, and at the end of each problem, she forces me to get it by making me do the problem on my own without looking at her paper. She's patient and encouraging, and every time I solve a problem right, she says, "See? You're getting it." And as I begin solving them on my own, she smiles and says, "See? It's easy." And with her help, that's what it becomes. Well, almost, anyway. When the warning bell rings, I pack up my things and Rosa says, "I can help you anytime." "Thanks," I say back. And this time I know I'll take her up on it.
"I can come over too," she says.
I hesitate, wondering how in the world that would work or how she could even offer. It would probably be a lot easier for me to go over to her house. But again, my mind is defaulting to relying on Fiona for help. Then she totally surprises me by saying,
"I would love to meet your dog. He seems so happy."
I blink at her. "How do you know my dog?" I'm feeling very strange, not fully grounded. And it flashes through my mind that I've been stalked by a girl in a wheelchair. She laughs at my expression.
"You used to run by my house. I live on Marigold, the house with the mermaid fountain."
For some reason, she's becoming easier to understand. I barely have to decipher at all. "I know that house. You're about a half mile from me. I'm on Harkin."
"See?"
she says with a lopsided smile as she motors toward the door.
"We're neighbors."
Mrs. Wall calls, "Bye, girls," as we leave, and adds, "Come back anytime, Jessica. You're always welcome." "Thanks," I call back. Then I hobble off to class. Chapter 5. That night, I have the running dream again. When I wake up, I cry, like I always do, but my tears are interrupted by the memory of something new in the dream. A mermaid fountain. A mermaid fountain and Rosa waving from her porch as I run by. In the dream, I don't really see her. I don't turn my head and look. She's a ghost on the porch, a cloudy vapor to my right, but I know she's there. I know it's her. I wonder about her appearing in the dream. The dream's been the same for so long, and this new dimension feels a little invasive. This is my dream. My escape to the place I love most in the world. The roads, the rivers, the trees, the bridge. Sherlock gives me a hopeful nudge and lets out a soft whine. "Sorry, boy," I tell him. "After school, we'll throw the ball, okay?" He hasn't given up on our old routine, but seems to like the new one just fine. I give him a hug and a nuzzle, and it crosses my mind that after I get my leg, I could walk him over to Rosa's. The thought, in its own small way, makes me feel better. Chapter 6. There is something different about Fiona. Something radiant. She denies it, but I don't believe her. "Are you in love?" I finally ask during science. She assures me she's not.
"Then what is going on with you?" I whisper. "And don't tell me nothing."
She finally caves, but only a little.
"You'll see."
"See what?"
I demand, but she refuses to say any more. So now I'm suspecting that it's not about her at all, that it's about me. But what could it possibly be? More cupcakes? She leads me to Cairo's room at lunch.
"Why?"
I want to know. "What is going on?" She's bursting at the seams.
"Cairo has something amazing to show you."
"What?" I demand.
"Stop asking. This is his surprise."
From the build-up, I'm expecting a room full of people, but it's just Cairo. Cairo? And his laptop. Cairo has ancestors from Poland and Ethiopia. He has dark skin and light eyes and the most beautiful hands I've ever seen. The fingers are long and graceful and they do a little flip upward near the tips. But the overall impression is one of strength. that his hands could move mountains. Cairo's hands are busy on the keys of his laptop when Fiona and I come in.
Jessica,
he says with a smile, then hits a few keys and turns to Fiona.
How much did you tell her? Nothing.
He grins.
I'm impressed. You should be, she says with a laugh.
Will one of you please tell me what this is about? He motions me over.
Have a seat.
So I sit in his seat and watch his computer screen as he activates a YouTube video. It's footage of a track, a race, some big event. The commentator is speaking in a language I don't know, Italian? What is this? I ask.
Shh,
Cairo says.
Just watch.
There's a close-up now. Close-up of something I don't recognize. It's got little nails sticking out of a rubberized pad, and the pad is connected to a long, dark piece of curved metal. And then the camera pulls back, and I see that there are two of these spiky padded pieces of curved metal, and that they are attached to legs. It's a runner? Yes. A runner on curved, spiked feet.
That's Oscar Pistorius,
Cairo says softly.
He is a 400-meter sprinter and a double below-knee amputee. Those are running prostheses.
He runs on those? I gasp, because it doesn't seem possible. His legs are sickles, hooks. I don't understand how he can even stand on them, let alone run. And yet, he walks along the track, and then he gets down in the starting blocks. I hold my breath, not believing my eyes. Cairo leans in and points out the other runners.
Look what he's competing against.
Every other runner getting into blocks has two legs, two flesh and blood legs. The runners are set, and the gun goes off, and the guy with the hook legs fires out of the blocks just like the rest of the runners. I watch, my heart pounding. He can run. He can run. And not only can he run, he's fast. While other runners struggle through rigor mortis bend, he gains ground, finishing the race in second place. My jaw drops when the screen displays his time.
A 46.9?
I gasp. Cairo grins.
Impressive, even on regular legs.
Cairo shows me two more videos. One with a woman named Amy who's missing one leg below the knee, just like me, and runs marathons, and another with an amputee my age racing for her track team. When they're done, he closes the laptop and looks right at me.
What do you think?
What do I think? Thoughts race through my head. It's amazing. Unbelievable. And freakish. These people look like cyborgs. Since I lost my leg, I've wanted to cover up, hide what I'm missing, make others forget there's something different about me. There'd be no covering that up. Is running worth becoming a cyborg? Cairo gently prods me for an answer.
What I'm asking is, would you want one?
My heart races at the thought of being able to run again, and my moment of doubt vanishes.
Yes!
He nods.
Okay, then, here's the situation. Running prostheses are expensive. We already have plenty of problems with insurance companies covering your basic medical issues, but even if we didn't, getting them to pay for one of these is almost certainly out of the question. So we had a team meeting yesterday and formed the Help Jessica Run campaign. Every runner volunteered for at least one of four committees: bake sale, raffle, car wash, and community donations.
He takes a deep breath.
Our goal is to buy you a running leg so you can get back on the track and compete on the team your senior year.
I look from Cairo to Fiona and back again. I want to say something, but what can I possibly say? There are no words for this moment. And I'm almost afraid to believe that I actually might be able to run again. Chapter 7. At home, I'm still having trouble believing it's true. I'm going to be able to run again? I watch the YouTube videos on our computer over and over, and slowly it sinks in. I'm going to be able to run again. I make my mother watch them. She's amazed. I have never seen anything like that. I make my sister watch them. She's direct. That is freaky, she says after seeing the clips. It's awesome, I tell her and give her a playful shove. She wants to watch them again, and when we're done, she says, you're really going to get one of those? My team is doing this huge fundraiser, and they're going to buy me one. They're doing bake sales and raffle tickets and car washes. Seriously? Kaylee asks. Seriously. My dad, however, is secretly not convinced. I hear him in the kitchen later talking to my mom. How are cookies and raffle tickets going to raise $20,000? I hold my breath, eavesdropping from around the corner. $20,000 for a curved piece of metal? The team will never be able to raise that much money. Don't give her doubts, my mom whispers sternly. She's happy. She's hopeful. She needs this. My dad's voice is hoarse as he whispers, but if it's a pipe dream, it's cruel. And what about the hospital bills and the $20,000 for her regular prosthesis? Does he have any idea we're going to cover those bills? I hold my breath harder. $20,000? My mind is reeling. If a leg costs that much, what did the hospital cost? For that matter, what did it cost to cut off my real leg? Look, my mom whispers, let's hire that lawyer and let's apply pressure, but let's not say anything negative about the team's plan to raise money. They're just trying to help. The lawyer wants half of whatever settlement we reach, and it might take years. So let's interview another lawyer. And if they tell you the same thing, well, half of something is better than half of what we've got right now. My dad sighs, and I can feel the tiredness that he seems to carry around everywhere. Why can't they just step up to their responsibilities? Haven't we been put through enough? The kitchen falls silent, and even though it's hard to hop quietly, I do my best to hurry away without being found out. And I do get away, but I can't escape the guilt. Maybe the team's money should go to pay my medical bills, or pay for my regular leg. Maybe there really are more important things than running. I feel like such a burden. Is it fair to even hope? Chapter 8. Fiona picks me up for school the next morning, and she's a little chatterbox, which I find exhausting, especially since it feels like I didn't sleep a wink the whole night. They cost $20,000, I finally blurt. $20,000. She pulls into the student parking lot. What to? Those running legs. I looked it up online. She shrugs. So we'll raise $20,000. I blink at her for a full minute, then shake my head and slouch in my seat. You're dreaming. She just smiles at me and starts chattering about something else. First and second periods seem to drag on forever. And at break, I seriously consider going home sick, but I've already missed way too much school, so I tough it out, convincing myself that it's important to stay. At lunch, Fiona decides we should eat in the courtyard. It's gorgeous out today. Who wants to be inside? She parks me on a bench near a scrawny elm tree where I feel strangely invisible as she goes off to fetch two mandarin chicken salads. Everyone seems to have somewhere to go, someone to see. It's not that people are trying not to look at me, they're just into their own things. It feels like I'm in a movie where everyone has a role and a place and a purpose, and I'm one of those silent extras they pay to sit and look like they're part of the show. I'm relieved when Fiona returns.
Sorry that took so long,
she says, handing over my salad. She checks me over. You doing